Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening and welcome to The Body Politic. I'm Peter Gurevich. Well, the election of 2008 is over, and a memorable one it has proved to be. Tonight, we look back to see what happened on November 4th and ahead to the challenges facing President-elect Barack Obama and his new administration. First, we turn to our election results in California. We've asked Thad Couser to come back. Couser is an associate professor of political science at UC San Diego and author of Term Limits and the Dismantling of State Legislative Professionalism. Welcome back, Thad.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
So we've had lots of things going on. Let's talk about the ballot propositions. They're the ones that made all the headlines, and one of the ones that made a lot of headlines was Prop 8. What is your reading on the results of Prop 8 and why and everything?
Well, I was surprised about Proposition 8. I got the prediction wrong. Many people did. And this was really one of the most surprising ballot initiatives in the history of modern polling, right? Never before has an initiative where a majority of Californians seem to have made up their mind against this initiative to vote no, right, actually won. And there was a serious no campaign against it, right? So it wasn't just that there were no voices opposed to this. People changed their mind about this issue, a very important issue, at a time when California was otherwise moving to the left, electing more Democrats to the state legislature, giving a landslide victory to Barack Obama, and having lots of left wing voters turn out. So this is the big surprise. How did the Yes on 8 campaign do it? One answer is they switched their message, right? So you didn't see a lot of advertisements showing gay couples kissing. This wasn't explicitly an anti-gay message. This wasn't saying that these folks shouldn't be allowed to marry. It was focused on children and family values. You know, do you want your kids to learn about gay marriage? That was a new message, and that seemed to carry the day for this initiative.
That's very interesting because a lot of the discussion has been it's new voters. The surprise, a lot of the headlines were Obama carries California by a big margin. Obama's a liberal. This is a liberal issue, but this goes down in flames.
Mm-hmm.
So that implies that it's all these new voters' behavior. You're giving quite a different interpretation in a way.
Yeah, I mean, one, we're not entirely sure how many new voters actually showed up in California. It looks like turnout wasn't nearly as high as we thought, partly because this election, the national level, Barack Obama had clearly won it before the polls closed in California. So we may not have seen this huge increase in new voters in California. But really, this election was decided by the old voters in California. You see a huge generational split on this. So
on
senior
Prop
citizens
eight.
On Proposition 8, right, and on gay marriage in general.
Right.
Senior
right.
citizens overwhelmingly in favor of Prop 8 and opposed to gay marriage. College age, you know, 20-something voters overwhelmingly open to gay marriage and against this proposition. The demographics are working in the favor of gay marriage, and it's very likely to come 2012 or 2016. We'll see another initiative up to reverse Proposition 8. And it may be successful because of those demographics.
But you're making a really interesting point that the advertising strategy changed people's minds, that this is not a matter of who showed up.
Mm-hmm.
This is people changing their minds. That's
and
really
we know this about propositions, that advertisements and campaign spending can have a real effect on their ability to win. And it helps explain the puzzle of what happened with Proposition 4. Why did it lose when Proposition 8 won? Prop 4, also a social conservative initiative that would have required parental notification of abortion, was leading in some polls and definitely ahead of Proposition 8. On Election Day, they flip-flopped. Well, one clear explanation of that is there was a big campaign against Proposition 4 and hardly any campaign in favor of it. So there are convincing commercials against it and no one answering it on the Yes on 4 side. Whereas Proposition 8 had one of the biggest grassroots-funded electoral, you know, 10... or I think, you know, $50 million in the end was spent in favor of Proposition 8, somewhere around that figure. That had an effect on voters.
So a lot of the energy comes from who leads these campaigns. Who led the campaign against 4?
Against 4?
Yeah.
It was an amalgamation of healthcare groups. And what you really saw were the faces of doctors saying this is not going to be safe for teenagers in America. Those were the effective campaigns against it.
Mm-hmm. So you had on that one, you had credible faces, doctors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
On the other one, you had people saying this is bad for children. And so that flipped it the other way.
Right. And, you know, you had people involved. The Yes on Prop 8 campaign was very much mobilized in the religious community. So it wins about 85% of the vote of white evangelicals in California. They did big outreach to the minority community, won a slim majority of Latinos and a larger majority of African-American voters, many of whom were reached through their churches. So it was the coordination of the faith community that in California that really boosted Prop 8 and led to a lot of the fundraising.
So let's move to redistricting. What did you think about that one?
So an interesting thing to note is the elections of 2008 are over, but we're not exactly sure what all the results are. Prop 11 right now is leading by a small margin. It's up about 90,000 votes on election night.
So Prop 11 is redistricting. It creates a commission to redistrict, takes it out of the legislature, blah, blah, blah. Four Democrats, four Republicans, four nonpartisans.
Right. So it would sort of totally change the way redistricting is done, really change California politics starting in the 2012 election, perhaps, and is leading by a very narrow margin because we still have at least about 1 million ballots to count to count in California. On the day after the election, we only counted about 75% of the ballots cast in California because so many people voted absentee and often turn those absentee ballots in on election day or the day before, and it takes longer to count these because you have to verify their signatures. So as we move to more and more people voting by mail in California, and we're up to about 40% more or more now, we're going to have to wait longer and longer for our election results for things
all the
like
way down,
Proposition
every
11.
County, city official, everything.
Sure, we're not sure who won the two city council races that were closely contested in San Diego this year, and that will really determine the balance of power. We won't know until these election results are certified in December, for sure.
So Oregon, where everything is this way, how long does that take? Same kind of thing, huh?
In 2000, when it was close, it took until, I think, Thursday or Friday of election week to find out what happened in the presidential race. This year, when Oregon had a close Senate race, it took until Thursday or Friday of election week to figure out that Peter Markley had beaten Gordon Smith. So that's where going in California.
So we don't know redistricting yet, and so we'll have to talk to you some other time about what the effects are going to be.
Right, and even if it wins, even if it wins, it's kind of unclear what this commission will come up with and whether they'll be able to agree or whether they'll deadlock and this will go to the state Supreme Court.
Right. So everything turns on who those other four people are, in a way, on who the citizens are and how those are appointed.
How informed this commission can be and what values they try to draw into their districts. There's so many competing values. Do you want competition? Do you want communities of interest? All of these things trade off against each other.
Okay, and what about the energy bills?
So this was sort of surprising in some way because there's a lot of money spent, especially yes on 10, but also yes on 7. Both of these initiatives went down by large margins. And really, this is an example of sort of voters kind of figuring out that the big environmental groups in California, the Sierra Club, the League of Conservation and Voters, were opposed to both of these initiatives, no matter how many windmills they had in their ads. The main environmental groups thought this was a bad idea. Voters figured that out.
So this confirms what all of our colleagues write about what voters look for cues. They see the endorsements, and they follow those, and it worked beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's talk about the future. Here we have Governor Schwarzenegger, Republican governor, in a state that's pretty blue, and lots of problems. What's going to happen?
Well, legislature's in a special session right now trying to resolve this enormous budget hole that's just opened in the last 2 months, and we're going to have to make some tough choices. Now, California has turned a shade bluer in this election. Democratic registration relative to Republican Party registration went up by about 5 percentage points in just about every coastal county. San Diego used to be 5 or 6 point Republican edge, is now even between the two parties. And this helped Democrats pick up a few more seats in the state legislature, but not enough seats to be able to pass a budget without the agreement from at least a few Republicans. So now the strategy is Governor Schwarzenegger's proposed an increase in sales tax. And he's trying to focus on term-limited Republicans who don't have to run in another primary in their district to cross over and vote with Democrats and with the governor to at least soften the huge cuts that are going to have to be made in California government.
So he thinks he'll get a better deal out of a lame duck legislature than he will waiting till the new one comes in because he thinks these Republicans who aren't running for re-election will make a deal.
Well,
is he right or is he wrong?
Well, look, given what we know about term limits, he's wrong, right? Legislators don't just walk off into the sunset and retire when they're term limited. They run for something else. Gray Davis actually got a moderate Republican to cross party lines and vote with him on one of his budgets. And that Republican was then basically excommunicated by the party. They put a lot of money into his opponents in primaries whenever he tried to run for something else to bury him and set the example that if you're term limited and you want to run for something else, you can't cast away Republican ideals. I think they'll send that same message out and it'll be very hard to pull off a few Republican
votes. So they won't be so responsive. So the governor might be disappointed in getting this lame duck group. And then the new legislature will be somewhat different, but not different enough.
Right. The new legislature is not going to have – Democrats are going to increase their lead above 60%, but not to that magic two-thirds majority they need in both houses to pass a budget on their own.
So more deadlock. And so we're going to have you come back and talk to what's going to happen the next time around. Thanks very much, Thad. That's really great. Next up, what the election results tell us about the American electorate and how the new president – may respond to the problems that lay in wait. Joining us now are Zoltan Hanel, an associate professor of political science at UC San Diego and author of Changing White Attitudes Towards Black Leadership. For the record, his book was published 1 month before Barack Obama announced his candidacy for president. Also with us, Stephen Haggard with the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies here at UCSD. He is the author of The Political Economy of the Asian Financial Crisis, and a noted expert on the politics of economic reform and globalization. Welcome back to the program, both of you, and joining Thad. So this has been a momentous election. Some of us are not able to get some sleep because we don't have to spend our time reading all the opinion polls. And so let's try to discuss this with our audience and interpret a little bit. I'd like to start with you, Zoli, because you're an expert on a lot of issues that are relevant to this. You may have seen this thing from the New York Times, which is absolutely fascinating. I've heard lots and lots of people talk about it. We know that the West Coast was very blue, the Northeast was blue, and the Midwest was blue, and some other places, Virginia, North Carolina, Florida. But what's interesting about this particular diagram is that it goes county by county, and it shows you change of percentages this time from last time. Which counties were more blue, and which counties were more red? So this is a pretty dramatic visual thing, and I wonder if you'd like to start out by commenting on this. How would our readers, they can look this up online.
Sure.
And there are lots of cute things that you can move the cursor over, it changes things, but would you try to interpret this
I think there's at least two stories in there, maybe three. The first story is obviously that we move left. The Republican Party, the Republican incumbent president, incredibly unpopular, and as a country, we move towards the Democratic side. And part of that story is that many whites voted for a African-American candidate, which is historic, massive change from, say, 40 years ago when the first black candidates were running. So a very positive story there and an overwhelming shift to the Democratic Party. The other story there is who didn't shift. And there were, in fact, the majority of whites did not vote for Barack Obama, and I think there's some sign of ongoing reluctance. And if you look at which whites didn't vote for Obama, part of it is a lot of the stories by state. So states where blacks made up over 15% of the population. 15%. So that most of the southern large black population states, white support for Obama was extraordinarily low. And that's showing up in that county figure. And that coincides with a lot of things. I mean, a lot of the whites in those states and counties there are less well-educated, working-class white voters. And they're the ones who tend to be more racially conservative. And so there was this enormous movement support, increase in white support for a black candidate, but at the same time, reluctance among a subset of white voters, and in particular, white voters who were maybe threatened by a larger black population or less educated.
Mm-hmm. And so does that correlate? I mean, when I look at that, it seemed to me that a lot of these counties were places where there are very few black people. The mountains of eastern Tennessee, Kentucky, western Virginia, those are areas with small black populations.
Yeah, and those probably would be areas with poorly educated whites. So I think that two things are going on. So the one is a contextual effect of, you know, states with large black populations. The other is an education effect, so more racial intolerance among less well-educated white Americans.
So it's race, basically.
Well, I mean, that's the argument that I would make. I mean, you can put other spins on it, but yeah, I'll stick with that.
And so what do we know about the new voters? There was a tremendous amount of discussion about young people, African Americans. What's the election results telling us about them?
Well, I think less change than maybe was forecast. So turnout was up a couple points from last time.
In terms of total election?
In terms of total,
sort of percentage of eligibles
who
voted.
And certainly black turnout was up more than the turnout of other groups, and youth turnout was up, but not anywhere near the dramatic changes for most groups that we thought, or that some people thought going in.
Uh-huh.
So For me, the bigger story is sort of an ongoing story that the white population is declining or is staying constant in numbers, essentially, and the Latino and Asian American populations are growing greatly. So their influence is increasing. Their turnout is also slowly increasing over time. So the electorate is becoming more non-white in terms of the number of people voting, and that is a significant story.
So let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, that's relevant to California and to economic issues. So there was a lot of talk that Hispanics were going to be values voters and they were going to vote Republican, and Bush did pretty well with Hispanic voters. He did pretty well in Texas. And this time around, what have we seen on but the behavior of Hispanic voters?
Hispanics, about two-thirds voted for Obama, voted fairly Democratic across the country. So the value story didn't play out at all. And I don't think it has played out in most elections that we look at. With the exception of Cuban Americans, Latinos have been fairly Democratic. Certainly a lot of Latinos identify as independent, but it looks like because the economy was such a big issue, they voted Democratic, and most large number of Latinos tend to be lower class. You also have potentially the race factor of and the immigration factor. So Latinos being concerned about Republicans being sort of pro closing down the border, clamping down on illegal immigrants, and Latinos are concerned about those things.
And what we've seen over and over again with Latinos and this idea that Latinos are going to en masse join the Republican Party because of especially Latino Catholics' positions on issues like abortion is that this is just not a very important position for Latino Catholics, an important issue, right? Latino Catholics in polls say they care about education and the economy, and only about 0.5% of them put abortion as their number one issue. So they may agree with the Republican Party, but this is not the key issue. And that is really set up that one of the bluest areas in that map was the New West. Colorado, New Mexico, Nevada, areas that went for President Obama, President-elect Obama, that had gone Republican the last few elections. A lot of that came on the strength of Latino voters.
Well, before the program began, we were talking a little about the future of the Republican Party. And, Steph, you were hearing some discussion about this. So let's speculate on that. What are the choices in front of the Republican Party about what to do?
Well, I think, conservative intellectuals are really grappling with how to reformulate an appeal that's going to address what I think is the longer-run economic issue, which is that basically wages among the working class have stagnated in this country. And they've stagnated over a long period of time. I mean, people have focused very much on the short-run effects of the recession. But the backstory is we've just seen this stagnation among less educated voters, voters that are in the bottom 25 to 50, even 50% of the income distribution. So if the Republicans don't figure out how to address the interests of that class of voters, you could look at a major realignment.
Well, that determines a little bit of what the Democrats do as well. Obama now faces a larger majority in Congress. We still don't quite know if this program is taping. We don't know what's going to happen in a couple states, so whether he has a super 60 or not, we don't know. But he's got a bigger majority. But how does that work out? Bigger majorities sometimes are very hard to manage, and there's a lot of divisions. We could talk about divisions in the Republican Party, about tack left, tack right, whatever that means in the Republican Party. But we have a similar problem in the Democratic Party. Bigger majorities can be hard to manage. What are Obama's choices in terms of economic policy?
Well, in a weird way, I think the depth of the crisis actually provides him some leeway, because it's just important to state the obvious. This recession is going to be nasty. We're talking negative growth of 3 or 4% for this quarter. Next year could be zero. There's high uncertainty in the forecast because of what's going to happen in the financial sector. But the question is whether that actually gives him some room to do things. So there are basically three things going on the policy front right now. One is, what do you do with this $700 billion? And that's just shaping up as a fascinating fight, because they've already spent a lot of the first tranche of that $350 billion. So there's a scramble on for what you do for the remaining $60 billion. So that's a big issue. Then you've got, what's going to happen in this lame duck session? I mean, is there going to be a stimulus? What are you going to do with the auto industry? That's going to have to go to the Hill. And then you've got what happens after he gets inaugurated. How many of the priorities he laid out during the election campaign is he going to be able to pursue? He's already committed to a tax cut, and then he was quite vigorous in saying, I want to do education, I want to do energy, I want to do health. So he's put a fairly expansive agenda up there.
Okay, but that seems, in the current, one of the reporters, you remember, kept asking them, under the current economic conditions, how can you possibly achieve your agenda? Okay, the election's over. We don't have to. Let's keep asking that question. How can he possibly achieve that agenda under these conditions?
Well, I don't think he can achieve his whole agenda. So, and if we go back to sort of the Republicans, there's a silver lining for the Republicans. The election results we just saw were a refutation of George Bush and what he had done. If we experience this long-term recession, Obama and the Democrats are going to be partially blamed for the ongoing nature of the recession, in all likelihood. So, you won the prize, but is that prize something that's going to mean 4 years down the road that there's a reverse shift if you can't turn the economy around? And Steph can say more on this, but I don't know how if a president has the power to change the economic fundamentals that we're dealing with here.
Well, I certainly, the economy is going to go through a shakeout, and the financial sector in particular is going through a shakeout. But if you look at this election compared to what Clinton faced, he actually has more room to act, arguably. I mean, you've even got Republicans who are saying you need another $200, $300 billion of stimulus, 1 to 2% of GDP. I mean, that's likely to be one of the outcomes of the summit, the financial summit, is you're going to get a coordinated fiscal stimulus. If you've got the rest of the world saying you need to give us 1 or 2% of GDP or else the whole world economy is going to go flat, the question is really going to be, what do you spend it on? Is it going to be tax cuts? Is it going to be energy? What's the mix of things? And what I think is going on right now is a huge fight over how that money is going to be spent.
The Bush approach was, you want to stimulate the economy, cut taxes. The Democrats are talking about actually spending real dollars on concrete things.
In addition.
Auto industry.
Well,
In addition.
Well, or...
Or healthcare, and right. Just as we see some bipartisan consensus about doing a big stimulus, you also see a bipartisan consensus on doing something with healthcare. There's a coalition called Divided We Fail that brings together labor groups and big business groups that are all pushing for, and they've already asked Obama to make healthcare a priority in his first.
Okay, now I find it interesting that we're talking about how to solve the current financial crisis and prevent the problem of for Obama of having terrible unemployment in 4 years. And you're talking about healthcare. How are these things? Healthcare seems to me a deep structural issue that is not connected to the immediate problem.
Well, everybody's healthcare is linked to their jobs right now.
Yeah.
And more people are going to be losing their jobs and losing their healthcare coverage. And the plan that Obama's articulated as candidate would help solve that problem.
No, I see its political importance because you lose your job, you lose your healthcare. But how is this going to fix the economy now? Right? The crisis that we're facing is we're having collapse after collapse. What can you do immediately to prevent that from getting worse?
Does anybody know the answer to that?
Well, one of the ideas on the table, and I wonder what you think about it politically, one of the ideas on the table is to start spending money immediately, to actually start spending money on highways, the classic public, start putting money out there in putting
energy
people,
and
another WPA.
And infrastructure.
Spending things, when did the Golden Gate Bridge got built? We all know the Hoover Dam, all that stuff was direct stimulus. The trouble with the criticism of tax cut is that people put the money in their savings account because they're terrified of things getting worse, so they're not spending the money. So one idea is spend money.
We're clearly already doing that, but and we will do probably more of that. It looks like the auto industry will get some more money. So I think that's going on. But in addition to that, I think Obama and Obama administration has some other concerns, some of them sort of values-based, some of them politically based, but certainly thinking about healthcare and energy and the environment are other things that
about the healthcare thing, a huge issue. You think there's a possibility of a healthcare deal to be made?
It sounds like at least in the short term, sort of shoring up healthcare for children will be something that can be agreed upon and passed. And then the longer term, the bigger issue.
So that has bipartisan support?
I think so. I mean, Thad, you might want to...
Yeah, not quite enough to override President Bush's veto of a children's health insurance expansion last year, but enough to pass it with the support of
the
president.
That would have required 67 votes, whereas a filibuster is only 60.
Right. So there's definitely support for the incremental approach of children of the working poor making sure that they have access to health care. Whether everybody gets it in this first... It's a big ticket item. But look, the two bits of political leeway that the Obama administration has are these. No one's going to worry about the size of the federal deficit, right? That's not a very salient political issue overall, and just that's going to be out the window. It's going to be terrible.
Numbers. I don't even know the words for the numbers that big anymore.
Right, right.
What's after a trillion? What comes after a trillion? I don't even know. Go ahead.
Right, a Google.
Too small.
Right, right. So that's not going to be a concern that's going to be tying their hands on something like health care. The second is the Obama administration is going to think of politically, what are voters going to say in 2012? Are they better off now than they were 4 years ago? Times are going to be really, really tough in January when this administration takes hold, and you're starting from such a low point that it gives you lots of flexibility to try to fix something in a number of ways or just wait out the business cycle, and folks should be doing better 4 years from now.
Right, and we've said nothing about foreign policy at the moment. What do we think he's going to do? Is he really going to get troops out of Iraq and send them to Afghanistan? Is that what we think he's likely to do? Stuff you want to?
I don't see any reason.
Speculate on that.
Well, I mean, you know, he's going to be so preoccupied with the economic issues. It's funny how quickly Iraq fell off the radar, either in terms of the electorate or in terms of the policy space. I mean, you know, I think he's going to be moderate. You know, he's the standard process with respect to the appointments. They're talking about people like Hagel or Gates staying on at defense, sort of centrist positions. But, you know, he ran on the position of getting out. I think he's going to get out. He's going to do it in such a way that it appears responsible. Afghanistan is a mess. And whether he wants to tie his horse to that, I think you're going to get some real pushback. I mean, that was an issue on which it was very important for him to appear tough. He had to have a place where he was tough. He was tough on Afghanistan. He may look at that again and say, do we really want to repeat?
We're going to have to stop this. This has been very interesting, and there's no end of stuff to keep going, and I'm sure we'll come back someday and talk about all these things. Thank you very much, all three of you, for doing this. That wraps up our election year programming for The Body Politic. We hope you've enjoyed watching it as much as we have enjoyed talking to our colleagues about the world as it moves by us at such great speed. We intend to return in the new year to continue providing informed and thoughtful analysis on politics and governance from the faculty of the University of California. Until then, I'm Peter Gurevich. Thank you and good night.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.